All right. Hello, hello, everybody. Hope you're doing well. Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain. Thanks to Scott Adams School, which you can find on YouTube and other places, for having me on this morning. And I had a little bit of time and wanted to talk about a couple of things. But if there's things that you want to talk about, questions, comments, issues, challenges, problems, criticisms, whatever is on your mind, I'm certainly happy to hear and provide what value I can. But I guess I'm a little bit agog as a whole, just a little bit agog, and I'll sort of tell you why. So I watched, after I was on the Scott Adams show this morning, I watched the instructions that the judge gave to the jury in the Lindsay Clancy case, because the trial is all wrapped up, and I guess they're just going to head off to their jury land and try to come to some kind of conclusion. And it's pretty wild. You know, if you want to be crazy, or if you're going to be crazy, I'll tell you, man, Massachusetts is where you want to do it. So in most places, and again, none of this is legal advice, just my opinion. I'm not a lawyer, blah, 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 amateur hour. But in most places, if you're going to pull an insanity defense, you have to prove that you were insane. Nope. That's not really how it works in Massachusetts, which is a pretty wild thing. And let me not give you my opinions before the facts. That's not necessarily the best way to approach it. So sorry about that. So in Massachusetts, the law system does not make Lindsay Clancy have to prove that she was insane. Once the defense put on reasonable evidence of a mental disease or defect, it is the prosecution, it is the state, that has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was still criminally responsible when she killed her three children. I mean, this is the opposite, right? If you say, I was crazy and I wasn't responsible for my criminal action, which makes it not a criminal action, then you have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. But once a mental defect or disease is claimed and established, then it is the state that has to prove, it's a prosecution that has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was still criminally responsible. So, of course, this is in Plymouth Superior Court. And of course, Lindsay Clancy does not contest that she strangled her children and then jumped out of a window. The issue is criminal responsibility. So closing arguments and jury instructions were given this morning. Now, Massachusetts does not use the word insanity as the legal term. The defense is lack of criminal responsibility. This is from Commonwealth v. McHool, H-O-U-L, 1967. In Massachusetts, a person is not criminally responsible if at the time of the act, she had a mental disease or defect, a legal phrase, not a DSM diagnosis, and because of that condition, she lacked substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality or wrongdoing of what she was doing, or to conform her conduct to the law. Either, right? Now, appreciate in this context means more than a bare intellectual knowledge. The instruction requires a meaningful grasp of the legal or moral significance of the act. And Judge William Sullivan read that standard to the jury this morning and told them Lindsay Clancy has no burden to prove lack of criminal responsibility. It is up to the state to prove that she had criminal responsibility beyond a reasonable doubt. So there are two standards in most common law systems. One is a civil standard, which is preponderance of evidence, like more than 50% likely. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is like 95, 97, 99% likely or reasonable. And of course, if you followed the OJ trial from way back in the day, then OJ was found not criminally liable, and then he was sued and found liable there. But the burden of proof is lower. The highest standard of proof is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, in general, we say, well, why isn't it 100%? Well, because if it's 100%, really there's not a trial. I mean, why would there be a trial? Like, if they've got you on video and you have no alibi and your fingerprints and the blood and smoking gun and witnesses, like, then your lawyer will say, look, you're just going to get convicted. And then, so they'll offer a plea deal. So proof beyond a reasonable doubt is something, I think, again, just sort of logically, not legally, that kicks in when somebody is claiming to not be responsible or to be innocent, and then it's a very high burden of proof. And if it's 100%, usually there's not a trial, so that's not such a big deal. So the defense. So Lindsey Clancy only had to introduce some evidence that, if you view it in the light most favorable to her, could have a reasonable jury with a reasonable doubt about, could leave a reasonable juror with a reasonable doubt about criminal responsibility. So, I mean, this is, of course, the expert testimony that I was talking about in the show last night, medical records, the fact that she said that she experienced this, Lindsey, this command hallucination, and, you know, the fact that she was treated, met that threshold, I would assume, pretty easily. So, of course, if you're going to say, look, I have a mental disease or defect, and you've never seen a mental health provider, and you've never been diagnosed, and you've never seen a psychologist or a psychiatrist, or never complained to your doctor about any problems, then that would be a tougher thing. But because, of course, she did, in fact, she was able to produce all of these issues that were going on. So it seems to me that that threshold has been crossed, right? The burden has been surmounted. So once that evidence is in, right, that she had some sort of mental disease or defect, and it seems that burden has been passed based upon her mental health history. So once that evidence comes in, the prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she did not have a mental disease or defect at the time, or if she did, she still had a substantial capacity both to appreciate wrongfulness and criminality and to conform her conduct to the law. So they can't lean on a presumption of sanity, and you have to prove that you're crazy. So the sort of prior 1967 case held that the old idea that most people are sane is only a common sense inference and standing alone cannot carry proof beyond a reasonable doubt. They can use planning, timing, words, concealment, motive, and expert opinions. They don't have to call in an expert, of course, in this trial they did. So that's unusual. In most states and in federal court, the defendant must prove insanity, usually by a preponderance of the evidence, sort of 51%+. Massachusetts puts the almost infinitely heavier burden to prove sanity on the state. So the Commonwealth case in chief said, of course, well, there were the killings, there's the timeline, the phone and watch data, the 911 call, the husband being sent on a longer errand, search history, medications, and so on to say that this was planned and appreciated and understood and this and that and the other, right? The defense case said, look, she's got a treatment history for mental illness, postpartum symptoms, command voice account, the experts saying bipolar disorder with postpartum psychosis, left without appreciation of wrongfulness and without the ability to stop herself. And then, of course, the prosecution rebutted with forensic experts saying she was severely ill, maybe she had depression and or bipolar too, but still knew right from wrong and could control her actions. They point to the short window while her husband was out, preparatory steps, and skepticism that a first-time command hallucination lasted only the minutes of the killings. So there seems to be a general agreement that she was both mentally ill and kind of a devoted mother. The fight in this case is whether the illness met the legal test at the exact moment of the acts. So even if she had some sort of diagnosis of postpartum psychosis, that's not automatically lack of criminal responsibility. And planning to kill your kids and executing on that plan is not automatically criminal responsibility. There's this two-pronged test to the whole thing. The judge, in his instructions to the jury, I guess the final instructions to the jury, left open lesser charges, second-degree murder, manslaughter, and so on. He declined a requested instruction that would have treated her prescribed medications as involuntary intoxication in the criminal responsibility charges. I mean, I would assume, again, I'm not a lawyer, but I would assume what that means is that if somebody doses you with LSD and you think someone's a demon who's trying to kill you and you attack them, then you would have a defense called involuntary intoxication. If you take the LSD yourself, you're responsible, but if you're dosed or something like that. Now, if the jury finds lack of criminal responsibility, I mean, that doesn't mean it's a walkout. It's a special verdict. Not guilty by reason of lack of criminal responsibility. Then the court starts civil commitment to a secure psychiatric facility. Maybe she'll get released later, maybe not. Depends on periodic findings and examinations that she is no longer mentally ill and dangerous. So Andrea Yates, who is another woman who killed her kids, often compared to this case, was found NGRI on retrial and remains confined. If the jury finds her criminally responsible on first-degree murder, Massachusetts imposes life without parole. So there's a lot of commentators who are saying that the legal standard favors Clancy on paper and still favors the Commonwealth in the jury room. Insanity-type defenses fail most of the time nationwide because jurors treat them as an excuse, especially when the facts are this grim. Massachusetts' burden shift does not erase that. Prosecutors only need to win one of the two paths in the instruction. No qualifying disease or defect, or remaining capacity on both the cognitive and volitional prongs. Defense experts say she had neither capacity. Prosecution experts say she had both. That is now for the 12 deliberating jurors. Now, this is all very interesting to me. I mean, it's an epistemological question. Epistemology is sort of the study of how we know things are true and how we know things are false, or at least how we have reason to believe things are true versus reasons to believe things are false. So if we take the simplest example that I can think of, again, not as a legal expert, but if we take the simplest example, it would go something like this. Lindsay Clancy or some woman did something terrible, committed these horrible crimes, but it turns out that she has a giant brain tumor that is eating up her neofrontal cortex, and she was showing signs of massive erratic behavior, instability, lack of emotional control, random, this, that, and the other going on. And then for some reason, she was not diagnosed with her brain tumor. But then, they give her a brain scan after she did these terrible things. And there's this big giant brain tumor that's eating up her neofrontal cortex, in particular, sort of seat of restraint and reasoning. And she continues to get worse and worse and worse. I assume the brain tumor would kill her quite quickly. I think, you know, from a, again, not a lawyer, legal, but from a moral, philosophical standpoint, we would say this was a horrible tragedy. Maybe we could get upset at the doctors for not diagnosing her correctly, but this is a horrible tragedy. And really, it was the tumor. And since the tumor is going to die with her, there's no point putting the tumor in jail, so to speak. So that is how I think morally this would occur. Or, you know, we've heard this in the sort of NFL things, right? The NFL, like some NFL player from years back, you know, does something horrible and violent and destructive and brutal. And then they do a brain scan and they find that he's had, you know, massive amounts of damage to his brain because of the repeated blows to the head as part of his career. And those are sort of, those are brain defects, the sort of physical defects, if that makes sense. So the problem is that this is all very goopy and subjective. Of course, you can see brain damage to an NFL player based upon repeated concussions. You can see that in a brain scan. You can see, or even in an autopsy afterwards, I suppose. I'm not sure how well you can see it in a brain scan. You can certainly see it afterwards. But, I mean, that you can see a tumor and you can see its, the extent of its damage and so on, right? So here's the problem, right? This is so subjective. And I know likey. I really don't like it, and particularly in cases of law when there's a bunch of subjective stuff. So in Massachusetts, it's a legal test, not a medical one. So if they say mental disease or defect, that doesn't have to match any kind of DSM diagnosis. So can she appreciate that what she's doing is wrong? That's not the same as knowing it. Substantial capacity to know, that's not a number. Like, how can you possibly figure that out? I mean, someone can be severely depressed, over-medicated, sleepless, and suicidal, and still be criminally responsible. On the other hand, a person could, I guess, plan, send her husband out, strangle three children in sequence, and still lack criminal responsibility if the jury finds she was a puppet or subject to some sort of command hallucination or something like that. The statute, of course, does not tell the jury which facts lead to which result. And of course, I mean, the DSM has a fair degree of subjectivity to it, in my opinion, because clinicians can argue about bipolar 2 versus major depressive versus postpartum psychosis versus medication effects and so on. The law only asks, like at the moment of the crime, and this was more than a moment, this was three crimes in a row, did some sort of defect in her mind rob her of a meaningful grasp of wrongfulness or the ability to stop. The diagnosis may be evidence, it's not the verdict. The other thing, too, is that you're going to rely on defense experts, but the defense experts are not dealing with anything objective and factual at all, in my view. So the defense experts say, oh, Lindsay had no appreciation of wrongfulness and could not possibly conform her conduct to the law. Prosecution experts say, yeah, she had her problems and serious ones too, but she still knew right from wrong and acted with purpose. What possible referee could be summoned from the depths of hell to declare one side is correct and the other one is not? I mean, the jury is going to say, well, I mean, there's this demeanor. The command voice Lindsay story was kind of, it came and went. She planned it. She did all these Google searches. She said to her children, go to God, baby. The 18-minute window, whatever else is going on. And beyond a reasonable doubt is applied to a negative. So once the defense put on, you know, some evidence of mental defect, prosecutors have to prove that Lindsay Clancy was not lacking those capacities. Because it's not, did she do it? She's admitted. It is, are we sure her mind still worked well enough? What does that even mean? What does that even mean? Nobody knows. Really, there's no objective way to know it. And that means that whatever the individual jurors happen to believe is what they're going to bring to the table. You know, if some jurors, maybe a little bit more on the female side here, postpartum psychosis, and oh, it's a medical catastrophe, it's somehow objective, she lost her reason, she lost her mind, others are going to hear, well, you know, she sent her husband away, she did the Google searches, she lied about some stuff, she killed the children in sequence and all of that. And it's like, well, that's responsibility. I mean, the judge's instructions generally refer to, you know, don't make your decision based either on sympathy or on horror. But it's impossible to avoid, I think. Women generally tend towards sympathy and men tend towards more horror and punishment. So, production of evidence for mental defects by the defense, persuasion beyond a reasonable doubt by the Commonwealth, by the prosecution, on these two legal prongs. The content is almost entirely judgment. What was Lindsay Clancy's inner state for just a few minutes in January 2023, reconstructed from records, experts, and conduct? And this is why, ideally, two people should be able to look at trial evidence and come to similar conclusions. You know, they may differ if it's like first degree or second degree, or I guess it's up to the judge to figure out how long the sentence is going to be, but it should not be the case that two people can look at the trial facts and come to opposite conclusions. Opposite conclusions is not innocent or guilty, because, right, you know, but was she responsible? Was it criminal or was it psychiatric? It is not, in my view, a good standard to say that two people within the framework of the law can both look at the same data and evidence and come to opposite conclusions about criminal culpability. And in this framework, as far as I can tell, again, just as an outside amateur, that is entirely possible. There's way, way too much soft language. And here's another problem. Well, two problems. One is that a lot of this is subjective and unprovable. So do we believe that Lindsay Clancy heard a voice ordering her to harm her children? Do we believe that? Well, there is no reason to believe it because there's no way to prove it. Did she hear voices in January of 2023 that told her to do these terrible things and then never spoke again? She'd never had them before. They just, in this, you know, couple of minutes, told her to do something. And of course, as I said yesterday, didn't tell her how to do it, in what sequence, in what way, with the exercise bands, which kid to go first, right? How to send her husband away, like that. That was all planned. None of that is accidental. Psychosis, to me, is when somebody has lost touch with reality completely. Not they can Google search, they can plan, they can send their husband away, they can lure the kids downstairs. Like, that's not, to me, again, just outside amateur opinion, That's not psychosis. Psychosis is truly insane people. Like, I remember when I went to visit my mother in the asylum. She was committed, as you may or may not know. When I went to visit my mother in the asylum, there were some psychotic people there, and they were kind of rocking in corners, you know, batting at things that nobody else could see, having arguments with potted plants. Like, they were gone, baby, gone. They were gone. And if you've ever talked with mental health professionals who've worked with people who are undergoing psychosis, it is a truly deranged state of mind. You can't pretend to be normal when your husband calls to throw him off the scent of potential danger, in my opinion, and from people that I've talked to. So it is almost circular in a way. If we assume, and I think it's reasonable to assume, that the normal state of a mother is to not butcher and strangle her children. Like, that's the normal state of a mother, almost by definition, right? That would make sense. If the normal state of a mother is to protect her children, or at least not kill them, then by definition, a mother who kills her children, or a father who kills his children, has a defective brain. It's sort of like, if the normal operation of your body is to pump blood to your brain, if you have some stroke, like some blockage or something like that, and your brain doesn't get blood, then by definition, you have a defect, because the normal operation is for the blood vessels to send blood to the brain, oxygen to the brain. And if that's blocked, right, then you have defective blood vessels. In the same way, of course, the normal operation of the heart is to give you a billion heartbeats over the course of your life. And if your heart stops beating, by definition, you have a defective heart. So all catastrophic deviations from health and normal behavior are defects. So it's not a medical diagnosis. It's not even a DSM diagnosis. It is, in fact, a self-proving hypothesis. Normal women don't kill their children. Somebody, a mother who kills her children, has a defective brain. Oh, but if she has a defective brain, then she's not criminally responsible. Again, I'm just talking philosophically, not legally. I can only evaluate these things from a moral standpoint. Of course, not from a legal standpoint. I'll give you another example. There are some people who do not appear to have any measurable conscience. So most people, if you sort of hook them up to EKGs and blood pressure monitors and heartbeat monitors and so on, and you show them a series of horrific torture images or brutal images of people being, you know, brutalized and hurt and harmed, most people, fight or flight kicks in, they feel horror, their heart rate increases, the blood pressure may go up or whatever, like adrenaline dumps into their system and so on, and they experience the activation of a horror-based nervous system responses. However, there are some people, you hook them up to the same thing, you show them the sequence of horrifying things being done to people in the most brutal manners we can imagine that would be legal, and they don't care. Their heart rate doesn't increase, they don't get any adrenaline, they don't have a fight or flight response, and there's some people who actually you can see pleasure centers light up in their brain. They enjoy it, they like it, they're sadists, right? They love watching that kind of stuff. They enjoy the images of torture. The general state of humanity, and I remember they used to show these appalling torture videos at an old nightclub I used to go to as a teenager called Nuts and Bolts, which I always found kind of odd. I understood it later. But most people, like the vast majority of people, when you show them images of torture and mutilation and so on, they react with horror and disgust and fear and loathing and so on. And then there's a small minority of people who don't really react at all. And then there's a minority of people who react with happiness, joy, pleasure at watching these things. Now, the standard is to react with horror when you see torture, to not care, to not react, or to react with pleasure would be, according to the normal standards of the human mind, a defective brain. A defective brain. Something wrong. you know, if you have a baby born with a congenital heart defect, it's because the heart isn't doing what the heart's supposed to be doing. It's not doing what most babies' hearts do. And if you have no conscience or you're a sadist, your brain is not doing what most people's brains do, which is to react with horror or torture rather than indifference or pleasure. So by definition, people who commit particularly violent crimes have defective brains. So they would fall into this category. So then wouldn't it be the case, logically, again, not legally, but logically, would it be the case that every single person who committed a crime, it would be a burden on the prosecution to prove that they were responsible, substantially responsible for knowing that it was wrong and being substantially unable to control their actions to conform with the law, that they were beyond self-control. I don't really know where that standard would end. I have no idea. And the other thing, of course, is that I suppose that you have to provide evidence and so on, right? So if you want to get away with some kind of crime, then all you do is you, for a couple of months, I don't know what the standard would be, a couple of weeks, probably a couple of months, you complain of being unhappy, of being wound up, of having racing thoughts, of being hyper and unable to concentrate. And you simply, no, you can't measure or test for any of these things. So it's all subjective I feels with a Z. So again, we're talking Massachusetts, right? So what you would do is you would simply, you would go and see a bunch of psychologists, psychiatrists, and complain to sort of primary care physicians about, you know, this, that, or the other. And that's laying your foundation, right? It's laying your foundation for, I had a defect for which there are records. And then maybe you wouldn't take the SSRIs or something like that. And then, having established the basis for a mental defect, it's not a disease in an organic sense or in an objective medical sense. Once you've laid the foundation for this defect, then you go do your dark deeds. I don't know. There's some report. I haven't looked into this in detail. There's some reports, I don't know if they're true or not, that Lindsay hung from the window rather than threw herself out of the window. So maybe she thought she'd twist an ankle or break a leg or something like that. And that would give her some plausible deniability as to being sane. But she paralyzed herself. So that's how you would lay the foundation. And given the law, and it would be fascinating to know, and I don't know if they've looked this kind of stuff up, it would be fascinating to know if Lindsay Clancy knew any of this stuff before she did what she did. And I'm not saying about her in particular, I'm just talking about things in general, because I assume that this stuff has been gone over and over in the trial, though I didn't watch all the trials, so forgive me for my lack of detailed knowledge in these kinds of things. So it's all very subjective. I feel unhappy. Therefore, you have a brain defect. And I hear voices, which can't ever be proven. And it's all very subjective. And subjectivism in the law is randomness and tyranny in practice. This is an old Randian argument that the tyranny is not the society with brutal laws, but with subjective laws. Like if they say, we'll lock you in jail for 5 years for spitting on the sidewalk. If you don't spit on the sidewalk, you're pretty much okay. But if they can just go after you or not, or you can be guilty or not, or innocent or not criminally liable or not, if it's all based upon subjective stuff, law and subjectivity is tyranny, in my view. In my view, things need to be very, very clearly delineated, right? Like you see these laws where it's like, well, if you cause offense, then you're in the wrong. And it's like, well, who knows what offense is? People can fake being offended. They can do all kinds of stuff. All subjectivity in law ends up being tyranny in practice. So I was quite surprised that in Massachusetts, after the mental defect is established, which it seems to have been from what happened with Lindsay Clancy for the months before she murdered her children or killed her children, then it is on the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was in enough control of her faculties that she's criminally liable. How on earth can you do that? Well, you can have a bunch of experts. Oh, expert says, yeah, she was. And another expert says, oh, there's no way she was. And how on earth are you supposed to come to any kind of objective or rational conclusion about that? I don't even imagine how that could possibly be the case. So I don't normally do predictions. I don't normally do predictions. And so this is all nonsense. But from my obviously amateur and non-legal opinion, not a lawyer, right? In my reading of the law, she will not be held criminally liable. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I don't think it's right, but nonetheless, in my reading of the law, certainly she's proven and established, and there doesn't seem to be much disagreement, even from the prosecution, that she had a mental defect. This bipolar 2 or major depressive disorder, or, you know, again, I know that defect does not equal the DSM diagnosis, but it seems to me that she has established that she has a mental defect. Can you prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was in enough control of her mind and body to know substantially, not just kind of know, but to know, and not just the, if she said, I know it's wrong, that's still not enough because it has to be substantial, whatever the hell that means. Can you prove to a 95% certainty that Lindsay Clancy, in those 18 minutes, knew what she was doing was wrong and had the ability to control her actions? Given that we have no time machine and we cannot read minds, I do not know. I do not know. I do not know how that can be established beyond a reasonable doubt. Let me give you an analogy. So if somebody goes up and punches someone, we would consider that assault, right? I mean, morally, right? However, if somebody has a sudden epileptic attack for which they had no prior history, and the arm just jerks out and smacks someone, we would say that that is not criminal responsibility, right? If someone were to claim, like somebody punches someone and then later says, I am not criminally responsible because I was not in control of my arm at the time. I had some kind of seizure, some kind of epileptic attack or something like that, right? And let's say that the person had never had that epileptic attack before or any kind of seizure before. There was no medical evidence that they had a seizure and they'd never had that seizure afterwards. Would we accept that and say, well, that person is not responsible because they had a one-time seizure and their arm was not under their control and it reached out and it smacked someone. Now, I get with the Lindsay Clancy case, there's the history of the mental health issues and so on. Again, I'm just talking about this individual instance. If somebody says, I was not in control of my arm when it went out and smacked Joe in the face, it was some kind of seizure, some kind of attack, some kind of whatever, right? Or if somebody says, a voice in my ear commanded me to smack Joe in the face, otherwise the world would end. So I smacked him in the face, and then I was like, oh, geez, I shouldn't have listened to that voice. That was really bad. And so on. Would we say, well, then that's fine. It's not assault, because you had a one-time seizure that never occurred, or you heard a voice that told you to do something that only came right before you hit Bob and then never came back again. I think we can all appreciate and understand that you cannot run a legal system, at least a rational legal system, on such a basis, because there's nothing provable. I heard voices, cannot be proven. If we're going to accept the excuse of a sudden onset, never to be repeated, epileptic attack that caused the arm to reach out and smack. And let's say it wasn't even just a jerk, like it was a punch, like the fist closed, right? You kept your thumb outside rather than inside so it doesn't break, right? We'd say, well, but you punched him, you know? It's like, but that was part of the seizure, man. That was part of the epileptic attack. My fingers curled in and just punched him. And because these are all subjective states that can't ever be proven. And that which is asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. That which is asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. I have an invisible spider on my forehead that's 3 feet wide but can't be detected in any way whatsoever. Is that like, well, maybe? It's like, no, you don't. you're not showing any evidence that you have an incorporeal spider that can't be detected by any means. So you're just making an assertion without any evidence, and therefore it can be dismissed. It doesn't sit in the maybe pile. You know, if somebody comes into an insane asylum and says, I'm Napoleon or Socrates or Jesus or something like that, do we say, well, maybe, you know, maybe space aliens resurrected Napoleon, kept him alive through some crazy technology, blah, 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 blah. No, that which is asserted without evidence, I'm Napoleon, can be dismissed without evidence. No, you're not. And I don't really know. And, you know, these kinds of trials are really fascinating to see how the law works. But I don't know how long the jury's going to be deliberating for. And it is really just deliberating based on your feelings and subjectivity and which expert do you believe. And the experts can't prove anything, right? If the expert comes in and says his DNA and fingerprints were on the gun, right? The gun that was used to commit the murder, his DNA and fingerprints were on the gun. Okay, there's an expert, right? Now they can get rebuttal experts and say, well, you know, the DNA, he's got a twin or you know, whatever it is, right? The fingerprints were smudged and what certainty do you have? And we've got another. So they're dealing with objective facts. But experts who come in and try to read the mind of a woman from January 2023 and try to tell you whether she was responsible for her actions or not, well, it's like that old Scott Adams thing where it's like, next week, a doctor with a flashlight shows you where sales projections come from, right? Although at least sales projections have usually some prior momentum to them. But that is the true reality of the situation. According to the law, and again, it's just my moral opinion, just a philosophical opinion, in no way, shape, or form a legal opinion, but according to the law, as I have read it, there is no way to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, 95% certainty, that Lindsay Clancy's state of mind in January 2023 included substantial knowledge that what she was doing was wrong and against the law, and that she had substantial control over her behavior. How could you possibly know? And of course, the experts hired by the prosecution say, yes, she did. The experts hired by the defense say, no, she didn't. And there's no objective test or anything. It's all speculation about state of mind from long ago. Under the law, as it stands, in my amateur philosophical opinion, she can't be held criminally liable, according to the law. Morally, philosophically, that's another question which I've talked about before. But according to the law, and I can't predict the outcome of the trial. Of course, nobody can. So I can't say, you know, maybe the jury is so horrified by the murders that they're just going to believe the expert that say she was in control of herself, knew that what she was doing was wrong and had substantial knowledge of acting against the law. Again, whatever that really means, no way to know. But maybe the jurors just are so horrified that they believe what the prosecution experts say, and maybe they're so sympathetic towards her that they believe what the defense experts say. But it is in any way the wind blows situation. So I cannot, of course, tell. Nobody can. But that's a problem too, right? That's a problem too. If the jury says, well, we're going to abide by the facts of the case, and if there are actual facts in the case that determine criminal liability, but what are the facts in the case that determine criminal liability? In a rational legal system, in a free market legal system, the standard would be medical diagnosis. She had a tumor. You know, we did a brain scan and some of her brain is not functioning properly. She was dropped on her head as a baby, like whatever. Whatever. Somebody had been pouring mercury into her ear while she slept or something like that. So there would have to be some medical facts on the ground in order to make this diagnosis. Because otherwise, you're talking about mind reading and time travel, neither of which are possible. Can you prove beyond a reasonable doubt that I had a dream about an elephant last night? Nope. Nope. You can't. The insanity defense in a rational legal system would require a biological basis. Because, I mean, if you've ever seen the movie, I know this sounds like a Whiplash side quest, but if you've ever seen the movie What's Eating Gilbert Grape, which was sort of Leonardo DiCaprio's introduction to the world outside of his sitcom days as a truly substantial actor, then he played a young man with a substantially damaged or underfunctioning brain. And he did an incredible job. And people can fake this stuff. They can fake psychosis. They can fake depression because there's no blood test, right? I mean, you can't fake cancer because you can find it when you do a biopsy. I mean, you can't fake, okay, I got a bee sting last summer on my hand, swelled up, and I went to the doctor. They put this little black marker saying, well, we don't want it to go past here, and put me in antibiotics and cleared it all up. But I couldn't fake that, right? If you can't fake a UTI because, you know, they will take a urine sample, look for bacteria and so on. But you can fake being crazy. Actors do it all the time. It's that Tropic Thunder line. Never go full retard, right? People, actors do it all the time. They fake crazy. They fake psychotic. They fake addicted. They fake mentally handicapped. They fake it all the time. People can fake this kind of stuff all the time. One of the reasons we can act and human beings have the capacity to act is you can con people if you act. So there would have to be a biological basis for claims of a mental defect. If your brain scans are normal and there's no disease or dysfunction that is in any way medically objective in your brain, then you have a functioning brain. You can't just claim epilepsy for one thing in your life. If there's no brain scan, no evidence of epilepsy, it's never happened before, never happened since, then it's just not, it's not provable that you have epilepsy. And if it's not provable that you have epilepsy, then, well, of course, even if you have epilepsy, if you don't take your medication, if the medication helps, and then you reach out and punch someone because of epilepsy, you're still responsible if you don't take your medication, blah, 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 right? I mean, can you imagine? Some guy plows into a schoolyard full of kids. He comes out dizzy, staggering, hands and knees, throwing up, breath stenches like a distillery. And he says, I'm not drunk, man. I'm not drunk. Well, you take a blood test, right? So there's something objective. Because, of course, if you did plow in to a bunch of school kids, heaven help you, you would then immediately pretend to be sick. And if there was blood alcohol, high blood alcohol levels, that would be a drunk driver. If there weren't, and there was no presence of any illness, no bacteria, no fungus, no viruses, no medical diagnosis, then it's like, well, you just stuck a hand down your throat and pretended to be sick, so that you would avoid responsibility. And these would, people can fake stuff. I mean, we know that, right? We know that. I mean, come on. Who hasn't had that Monday morning phone call? Oh, man. Sorry, boss. Oh, sorry. Like, I feel like crap. I don't think I can come in today, man. I'm so sorry. I'll keep you posted. Like, who? I mean, everyone at one time or another has faked an illness. I remember there was a TV in my boarding school, and I wanted to watch TV, and I pretended to have an earache. I pretended to have an earache so that I could go into the nurse's room, which was also nice and warm and cozy. I could go into the nurse's room, and I could watch TV and chat with the nurse and not have to go to bed because I've always been a night owl, and it was no good for me. So everyone's faked it. Come on. Except my wife. So we know this. So there has to be objective tests because people can fake stuff and people can lie about stuff. And I think we can safely ascertain that if somebody's willing to murder their children, they're probably also willing to lie about stuff. I think in the hierarchy of values, liars versus filiciders are more common. So I just wanted to get these thoughts out. If, in my view, again, amateur, idiot, philosopher, not lawyer, in my view, if the jurors follow the law, she's not criminally liable. If they don't follow the law, who knows, right? They may be admonished by the judge if they don't follow the law. So as a whole, I would say she's going to the asylum. She ain't going to the jail. And I also would assume that in the asylum, she's going to make an enormous, miraculous, rapid recovery. We'll see. We'll see. They could be out for a couple of days or more. But those are my thoughts. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, so much. I appreciate you dropping by today. Freedom. Man.com/donate. Don't forget wordwardebate.com to get your tickets for Nashville. And I will be also in Vegas in November with debates as well. And I look forward to seeing you either in Nashville or in Vegas. I'll keep you posted. Thank you so much for dropping by today. Have a beautiful, beautiful afternoon. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.